Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. It's the 3rd of July, 2013, and tonight we're joined on the line from Hong Kong by our old friend Pepe Escobar, international man of mystery, who seems to be in a different location every time we interview him. Pepe, it's great to have you on the program tonight. Thank you for joining
us. Great to be with you, James. And look, right behind me, Edward Snowden is hiding my apartment.
There he is. Wow. All right, NSA, if you're listening, which we know you are, please go go find him.
NSA, here, I live in Shengwan, Hong Kong.
All right. Pepe, it's great to have you on, as always. And last time you were joining us from Sao Paulo, but tonight you're from Hong Kong. But you are, of course, keeping your eye on everything that's going on around this wacky world of ours. And tonight I want to turn our attention back to Brazil for picking up where we were talking about last time. We were talking about some of the economic problems and or bright spots in Brazil. And tonight I want to talk about what seems to be spilling over with this salad revolution, vinegar revolution, whatever it's going by these days, which the mainstream narrative seems to have focused on the idea that this is about transit fares, but I think we all understand this has to be about something greater in the societal conversation that's taking place in Brazil. But for novices and outsiders like myself and many of the people in the audience who really aren't familiar with the politics there in Brazil or what's going on, can you explain to us where these protests are coming from and what this this political movement really represents?
Well, it started, in fact, about the bus fare, the famous 20-cent bus fare hike, by a law student and a history professor in one of Brazil's public universities in São Paulo. So it started as something very simple. They coined their movement the Free Pass Movement. The idea was to give free transportation for most people in the big cities, especially in São Paulo, which is something that could be done easily if there is political will. This thing starts to snowball little by little, I would say on a day-to-day basis, first few demonstrations, and the repression was Erdogan-style in Turkey. It was bloody. Even journalists were hit by rubber bullets. So the whole thing after this first much larger demonstration really snowballed to, I would say, hundreds of thousands proportions, culminating in 1 million people marching in Brazil in all the big cities, which is something that you had never seen in over 20 years. You have to put this in perspective. Lula stayed in power for 8 years. Dilma was elected in 2010. So we have roughly a decade of the Workers' Party, not as the top opposition party in Brazil, but as part of the establishment. They are the new ruling class, let's put it this way. But at the same time, they are in direct conflict with the old Brazilian ruling class, the right and the extreme right in Brazil, which are still very powerful. This means people who control the media, four or five families that control the media in Brazil. It's as tight as in the U.S. in terms of total control. The landowning oligarchy, which is one of the most arrogant and ignorant in the whole planet. Like, you know, in Turkey and in Egypt, in India is a serious match, but the Brazilians are in a class by themselves. It's, of course, we all know among the emerging powers is the number one champion of inequality. But in this past 10 years with Lula and the first 2 years of Dilma, we had between 30 and 40 million Brazilians that for the first time ever in the history of the country ascended from the margins of society of the lower proletariat to become lower middle class and in many cases middle class. So, of course, their expectations, now that they are middle class, are much higher. They want a standard of living that could be comparable to some countries in Europe, with a welfare state that would care for them, like the declining and the devastated welfare state in Europe. And, of course, they want less corruption in government, because the elites in power politics in Brazil may have changed, but the level of corruption is absolutely staggering in terms of pork barrel contracts. You know, this the whole story around the constructions of the arenas for the 2014 World Cup is a story. In every big city, it's a story of a monstrous racket And obviously, if you are linked to local party politics or if you are a construction company, perfect. Just like here in Hong Kong, by the way. We all know that Hong Kong is run by a cartel related to real estate development. In Brazil, it's not much dissimilar. But the difference in Brazil is that 200 million people agglomeration, let's put it this way. So we have a conjunction of factors. People were fed up. The straw that broke the camel's back was this bus hike fare. But this was a much larger anger against the way the political system is run in Brazil. Corruption inside the political system all over the spectrum from the extreme left to the extreme right and everything in between. The fact that still in terms of inequality, nothing is going to change, even if we have 34 million more million people that are part of the middle class. And of course, like some of the banners in the demonstrations express graphically, we need hospitals, we need health care, we don't need new arenas. So instead of spending $15 billion in new arenas, no $15 billion was and will be spent in the next few years in health and education, for that matter. The level of university college education in Brazil, for instance, you know, I have friends who are university professors. They tell me that the graduates are barely literate nowadays. So when you have this all together, people went out in the streets. And another thing is very important. Who was in the streets? It was a cross-section of the population, in fact. You had lower middle class, mostly students, a lot of people with college education, university education. The Google generation, especially in the big cities, São Paulo, Rio, Porto Alegre, Curitiba. But also we had, you know, the poor guys who have to spend 4 hours a day commuting those buses, and they simply cannot afford to pay 2 cents extra every day because it's not enough. You know, their salaries are not enough. So we had this cross-section, but also very interesting, the real mass of Brazilians, which the people who make less than $2 a day, in fact, and I would say would be like 80 million at least out of a population of 200 million. They were not part of it because they saw, no, this is a middle class thing, it's not our struggle. So I was always thinking during the protest, if these people, the people who live in the favelas, hard workers, but who can live in the favelas, who decided to live in the favelas, or they cannot afford to live out of the favelas, if they were out in the streets as well, they would take over São Paulo, Rio, and the big cities because they have the numbers. They only don't have the political will, the political organization to do it. So this was essentially a middle-class movement, yes. But in the future, if nothing changes in terms of less corruption and in terms of being a less unequal country, these people in the real margins, they will go out in the streets, and then it's going to be really, really hardcore. So I think we saw a first stage of a long process that just started now because expectations are much higher, of course. A lot of people are saying that President Dilma, she took time to react. Yes, because first of all, don't forget that the Workers' Party was a party that was formed by demonstrations in the streets as well. When they were a small party in the late 70s, in the early 80s, and the campaign for direct democracy in Brazil, which gathered steam in the 80s, the Workers' Party, they were in the streets against the old elites as well. Now, they are in the opposite position. They are part of the elites, they are in power, and they see people in the streets against their own policy. Not necessarily against their own policy, but the fact that there's a lot of corruption inside the Workers' Party as well. So what this middle-class movement in Brazil wants is a general cleansing of the whole system. Of course, it's a very utopic and romantic platform. It is an horizontal movement, of course. There are no specific leadership. In fact, after a few violent confrontations in some of these demos, the original guys in the public university who came out with the free pass movement, they said, look, we're not going to organize any more demonstrations because we already got what we wanted. This means no more bus fare hikes. And from now on, we have to discuss with other sectors of society, what do we want? And when President Dilma reacted, to her credit, she said, okay, I hear you. I know what you want. Let's start a national dialogue. We need a reform of our constitution. We need a reform of our political system. Let's start doing this. She proposed a referendum that was rejected by who? The land-owning right, or this extreme right in Brazil. The old elites, they don't want to talk about it. They just want to go back to power. They don't want to discuss what people really want and what people in the streets are demanding. So it is also a very polarized thing. The only thing that the right had in mind is that Dilma lost 20% of her approval rating during the protests. She fell from 57 to 30. But this is not the most important thing. She can go back to 57 in 2 or 3 months' time. It's a long time in politics until the next elections in Brazil in 2014. The merit of Dilma is that she proposed a national discussion of what to do about the imbalances of the Brazilian political system. So let's see if from now on we're going to have this real discussion, or if it's going to be scotched by the right, because they are only thinking about coming back to power.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis, and it does help to put it in that context. But recently we were talking to Professor Michel Chasadovsky, globalresearch.ca, about this, and he was talking about some of the more historical roots of this recent protest, and looking at the way that the Workers' Party has really failed to live up to its mandate as the alternative to the neoliberal philosophy and ideology, and in fact has kind of cozied up to the IMF and the World Bank in ways that that seem to betray what the Workers' Party was supposed to be about. What's your take on that analysis? Do you think there's some duplicity going on here with the false front of the Workers' Party, or do you think they genuinely do mean what they're attempting to sell?
Right. They did not cozy up to the IMF. No way. In fact, they pay their debts to the IMF. Now they're one of the IMF's creditors, top creditors, in fact. And some of the top sub-directors in the IMF, they are Brazilians as well. They are Indians, they are Brazilians, Chinese. They never get to the top for obvious reasons, because we know for obvious reasons it has to be an European and American IMF World Bank. In terms of neoliberalism, yes, the Workers' Party, Lula especially, less with Dilma, she's a more statist, let's put it this way. But Lula was a darling in Wall Street. Brazil was neoliberal for the 8 years of Lula, remains significantly neoliberal under Dilma, with a little more space for state-owned enterprises as well. But, you know, this in terms of the fundamentals of the system, how it works all over the world, Brazil is absolutely part of it. It's not trying an experiment like Bolivia, for instance, or it's not trying something like Venezuela, and not to mention Cuba. No way. So in economic terms, until virtually yesterday, Brazil was a paradise for international investors, because in terms of hot money flowing into the São Paulo Stock Exchange, it's absolutely crazy. It's one of the best returns you can have on the planet. As soon as the fun fest was not as good as it was until, let's say, a year ago, it's very simple. You just need to read the Financial Times and The Economist. They start bashing Dilma directly, in fact, because now Brazil is going to become a statist paradise like the old Soviet Union. That's ridiculous. Because until virtually yesterday, a lot of people were making a lot of money with hot money flowing into the Brazilian economy, especially in the Brazilian stock exchange, not the Brazilian economy. It was not productive investment. So now it's not anymore. And of course, they have to fight inflation. Real inflation, they say it's a 3, 4, or 5. In fact, people in Brazil tell me all the time, real life inflation is over 25-30%. They compare the price of tomatoes or potatoes as 3 months ago to what they're paying now. And yes, it's 25-30%, the real inflation that people actually feel. So it's a balancing act. You have to be neoliberal. You have to be facilitating state-owned enterprise investment. You have to control inflation, but you have to please international investors. You have to try to diminish inequality and at the same time don't leave everything, you know, an over ultra hot economy going everywhere. It's a very complicating balancing act. So it, for the Dilma government, it's the maturity is now how to organize all these problems. And many of these problems were left by Lula. Lula was thinking about the big picture. He was traveling all over the world, and he was selling Brazil insertion in this very rarefied group of world powers that have influence globally. He managed to do that. He succeeded in that. But he left the day-to-day management of the country with a bunch of people, and some of them are either incompetent or corrupt or both. And that's, you know, Dilma inherited that. She's a very good technocrat. But, you know, what's the point if you're a good technocrat when people that surround you, you cannot trust them? So every month she's firing a minister, literally, because this guy is implicated in something, a political scandal, corruption, etc. So it is a very complex, Brazil is as complex as China, Russia, and India, these big continental-sized countries with extreme internal inequality. I would say that the good thing about these protests is that it forced the government to start rethinking a lot of their policies and go back to civil society and ask civil society, okay, what do you want? Present us a catalog of demands, and let's debate and study that. Well, this is something that even in a so-called European democratic powers is not happening anymore. So that's the positive point.
Well, you paint an interesting picture, and the sense that I get is that perhaps we've entered into a new age of Brazilian politics. I mean, at the very least, there's the sense that a newly emergent middle class is starting to flex its political muscle and discovering it has political muscle of some sort. Surely this is going to change the political calculus from here on out. So if you can gaze into your crystal ball, what do you imagine coming of this?
James, sincerely, I prefer not to. Especially because Brazil, in terms of crystal ball for Brazil, it's absolutely impossible. Well, I was born there. I lived there part of my life. I still remember the days when inflation was 150% a day. I still remember when people, when they got their monthly salary, they had to run to Citibank to buy U.S. dollars. And then every 2 or 3 days, they'll get a $100 bill to pay their bills. And change their $100 bills in the local currency at that time was Cruzeiro, Cruzado. They used to change the name of the currency every month. So you cannot use your crystal ball in terms of Brazil. You cannot. What is very clear is that in terms of political consciousness, it's people nowadays, after 10 years of the workers, 8 years of Lula, two years of Dilma, people are very much aware of what the country lacks. They are very much aware about the level of corruption across the political spectrum. They want to practical measures to ease inequality. They want a fight against special interests. For instance, the mafias that control the transportation businesses. So they want, you know, real policies to level the playing field, especially. And especially, very, very important, investments in health and education. Well, Dilma already promised a special oil fund to invest in education, but this is just a promise. And don't forget that this oil fund will depend on the exploitation of the new reserves in the pre-salt deposits. So this could take years so we can see the actual results, right? So As I told you before, I think that a change of mentality in terms of the governing elites is in the cards now. But this could take decades to happen. That's the problem.
Well, that's a fair answer. And to be honest, I hate the crystal ball question when it's asked of me. So I think you're perfectly fine to answer that. All right. A lot to ponder about this Brazil situation, but we'll have to keep our eye on it and see how it unfolds. But other than that, let's cast our net a little bit more widely here. What else are you working on at the moment for your articles for Asia Times or any of your other outlets?
Well, I've been following, it's crazy, but I've been following closely Iran, Syria, Turkey, China, U.S. foreign policy, and on top of it, Brazil. I couldn't even follow what's going on in Egypt, otherwise I go crazy, as you know it, right? I'll be following closely some pipeline stun details, like the death of the Nabucco pipeline, for instance, which means that now it's Russia against Azerbaijan in terms of supplying gas to Europe. And there's going to be a market for both. In fact, I think both are winners in the situation. China from now on is an extremely complex story in terms of how they're going to actually organize on an everyday basis this mass urbanization that will affect between 250 million to 300 million people over the next 10 years or so. It's a completely crazy story. In terms of Turkey, the future of Erdogan after what happened, because just like Dilma in Brazil, there are no official polls in Turkey yet, but he lost the so-called 55% majority that the AKP said that they had before. Now it's not a majority anymore because of the reaction against Taksim. And of course, after summer, I will be following closely Iran and what Rouhani, empowered Rouhani, will be able to, how he's going to juggle the P5+1. This is going to be extremely interesting because now there is this groundswell, at least among a few Europeans. Maybe we can restart the dialogue, but we still don't know what the US is going to do. And this is the major story, in my opinion, from now on. This so-called rebel offensive against Damascus starting next month in August with the so-called new weapons furnished by the U.S. What is the end game of this story? Does this mean that we're going to have a Lebanese-style prolonged civil war in Syria for the next 10 years or so? Does it mean we're going to have a disaggregation of the Syrian state and a disaggregation of the Iraqi state side by side? Because don't forget, the cross-border Sunni jihadi, shuttle between Syria and Iraq, and the stabilization of Lebanon at the same time. So, you know, in fact, I'm working on all these stories at the same time from now on because they're all interrelated. Not to mention what is going to be the outcome of our friend Snowden has been revealing. Don't forget that this is just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, everything that Snowden said so far is not exactly news. It's not big, big news. Greenwald said this week that he has a bomb coming. So I'm very curious about that. Something that, you know, will be really destabilizing. We all know that as a spy against China, Hong Kong, Russia, the Europeans, it's obvious. But we are expecting something else.
we'll keep fastened to the edge of our seat. I don't know how you juggle all of this without your head exploding, but I guess that's just the kind of international man of mystery that you are.
Same. We try to do the same thing. Huh? We cannot rely on mainstream media to do that. I remember when I was a teenager, I used to look up to Le Monde, for instance, or even the Washington Post as a beacons of information. This was a long time ago. You know, this media is completely discredited, and they are more pathetic by the day, in fact. So, you know,
absolutely. Well, we've entered another era of information, and you are at the forefront of that, I think. So I wish somebody would step up and create a website that collates all of your work from across the internet. But until that happens, of course, people can type Pepe Escobar into a search engine and find bajillions of hits on all sorts of subjects. So, Pepe, it's always great to talk to you. I really do appreciate your time tonight.
It was a pleasure. And Snowden right behind me says...
Good night, Snowden.